right, please be seated. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Case that we have in this session of the morning is State versus Dodson. Counsel, would you please make your appearances? All right, and just so you all know, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley is appearing by phone. So you have the full court sitting on this particular case. I would like to welcome Xavier High School here today from, I think, Appleton, right? Congratulations on being back at school and being here and part of Court with Class. It's really quite a program. I hope you found it to be interesting. What they do is study the case and then come here, listen to oral arguments, and then they have a chance to talk with a justice today, that's Justice Karofsky, not about the case, but about the court and how we do things, and they can ask questions of her. It's a fairly informal setting, but she'll be back out to talk with you after we conclude oral arguments this morning. So welcome. It's nice to see you all here. It's been a while, but welcome. All right, we will start up in the State versus Dodson case. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes.
All right, please do so.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jorge Fragoso. I'm with Gimbel, Riley, Guerin, and Brown, and I represent the petitioner, Octavia Dodson. Octavia Dodson was a law-abiding gun owner who became a concealed carry permit holder on July 29, 2014. Like many fathers in Wisconsin, he kept a firearm to protect his family, himself, and his home on Milwaukee's north side. After the tragic circumstances that led to Octavia's guilty plea, the court punished him for choosing to purchase a firearm. The court claimed that the day Octavia became a legal gun owner and concealed carry permit holder was the day that he adopted a distorted, misguided, and paranoid view of the world that made this incident all but inevitable.
Counsel, can I stop you right there? Is that exactly what the court said? The day he became a... Didn't he say that set these facts in motion?
I could... Yes, Judge, Justice, I was about to read you that quote.
Yeah, please do.
I do strongly feel that the day that you applied for that concealed carry permit and went out and purchased that firearm and that extended magazine, the court said that day, I think on that day, you set in motion this circumstance.
And did he use the word paranoid?
He did not use the word paranoid. He used the words distorted and misguided, I believe.
To describe, distorted and misguided was to describe his beliefs, correct?
He used them twice.
The threat. Yeah, if you can point those out as well, thank you.
Sure. But it is clear to me that you were operating under some misguided belief, some distorted view of the world, that somehow Deshaun Freeman was a threat to you, when in reality, it was nothing further from the truth.
Isn't that a true statement? And isn't that really what second-degree homicide is? Is that it wasn't, his beliefs were not correct? He felt threatened, but that was not the case?
What second-degree is that the belief that he was in imminent danger was unreasonable to a jury. It doesn't mean that there was no reason to feel threatened or that there was no threat involved whatsoever. There's physical evidence in the record that establishes that Deshaun Freeman is the one that came at Mr. Dodson based on where his body was at the time, based on the fact that the iPhone was left dangling from the car door. That indicates that Mr. Freeman got up rather suddenly based on the trajectory of the bullets that hit the house behind him. It looks as though Mr. Dodson was much closer to his car. I know that initially he said he was still inside his car and then said, well, I had gotten just out of my car, but it does seem that the distance between the two cars was traveled by Mr. Freeman, who it seems was charging at Mr. Dodson. Mr. Dodson's statement is that Mr. Freeman ran at him and yelled not just, you know, profane language, but threatening language. He used the F word and the N word as he charged at him, a stranger, in the middle of the night in one of Milwaukee's most dangerous neighborhoods.
Counsel?
Yes, Judge.
I should ask first. Are you done answering the question?
Judge Dallet, I'm sorry. I wanted to clarify that there was some threat, and whether or not Mr. Dodson was willing to go to trial and risk whether a jury would believe that he used perfect self-defense or not, there was some basis for him to believe that he was being threatened.
Right, but do you agree that there could also be a basis for a judge to consider that belief distorted in terms of what he why he shot a man coming at him in the street?
Right, so there's a basis for the judge to believe it's incorrect. And this in some ways reminds me, obviously, with a lot of differences, but some of the police shooting cases we see where people try to reconstruct what happened, whether defensive force was used, what the police officer saw from his vantage point. What we know is what Mr. Dodson told us, that he saw a young man he didn't know charging at him and yelling. Now, the court can certainly choose to disregard that, but then the court would also have to disregard where the people were in relationship to one another, to the cars in the street, the fact that the phone was left dangling that was mentioned in the complaint.
Shouldn't we also be considering...
Justice Kroski, respectfully,
so
can I...
Thank you,
Justice. Go ahead,
you can continue.
I appreciate you.
Thank you. Okay. The conviction is one thing. Are you fighting the conviction?
No, Judge.
The sentencing.
We're asking for a resentencing.
Okay. So you're asking for a resentencing, as I understand it, based upon the court's reliance on an improper sentencing factor.
Correct.
Right? And the improper sentencing factor, as you see it, is when the court, in your view, relied on this person being a gun owner, possessor, lawfully, and having a carrying concealed weapon, and somehow punishing your client for that status as a lawful gun owner rather than something else, right?
Correct, Judge.
And just to make the record whole as far as today's proceedings, as I understand the statement that you want us to take a look at, it is when the court said, I have seen over time how individuals, when they are possessing a firearm, how that in some way changes them. I know that this is only speculation on my part, but I do strongly feel that the day you applied for that carrying concealed permit and went out and purchased that firearm and the extended magazine, basically, it set in motion this shooting, right?
Correct. That's one of the two statements. There's a further portion later where he essentially says a very...
Okay. So... what is the best case law that you have to support the proposition that this is somehow an improper factor?
Well, the framework for analyzing an improper factor is set out in Alexander. And so the court does have to determine first whether the factor is improper. And then Alexander shows how to use that to determine whether or not to grant the resentencing. As far as whether or not it's improper, I am arguing that it's improper because Mr. Dodson was exercising his Second Amendment right by not just getting his concealed carry permit and purchasing his firearm, but also even the fact that he got an extended magazine. None of that was him doing anything wrong. But the court still goes back to that moment. And if I may just explain a brief, I think, something that needs to be explained here. I think the court's comment on this day you set this in motion is revelatory. I think that shows why the court is unwilling to consider some of these other facts. The time of night, the fact that a stranger is running at him, yelling threatening words, the fact that Octavia had very little time to react. The court disregards that and instead says, you had a misguided, distorted view of the world, and that's because you were holding a gun, because you had a gun in your hand, and the gun made you think everything was a threat, when in reality, there was some level of threat in front of him. Now, Mr. Dotson may have chosen to enter a guilty plea. He may have, in retrospect, even gone back and forth on whether or not this was a threat that required him to discharge his firearm, but the decision he made was, is he going to go to trial and risk this or not?
Now I have a question for you on what part. I understood your argument to be that on this day, because he possessed a firearm, his reaction was different. But also, and more importantly perhaps, I thought, to your argument, was that the court referenced the fact that on the day he applied for carrying concealed and went out and bought a firearm and went out and obtained the extended magazine, it was that carrying concealed application, buying a firearm and having an extended magazine, that set into motion the circumstances, namely his commission of this crime.
Correct. So I believe that the court, with that statement, when the court says on this day, it meant on the day that he purchased the firearm, not on the day that this happened. The way that I think it impacts the court and how the court actually relied on that belief, the belief that the court explained when it said on this day you set it in circumstance, or you set the in motion the circumstance, is that then the court was unwilling to look at the facts of the case and instead said the reason you shot him was because you had a distorted view of the world, because holding the gun, like I've seen many times before, gave you a distorted view of the world. And I think that that is an improper factor at sentencing.
Isn't the test, counsel, though, whether he was punished solely for exercising the constitutional right of possessing a firearm? I mean, isn't when you have an improper factor or improper statement, that's what our case law talks about. So how do you get to the point where, yeah, you made these statements, how is it that these statements show that he was punished solely for exercising that right? I mean, there's all kinds of other facts we have here, you know, including the conduct. I mean, a lot of it's on page 20 of the state's brief, 20 and 21. About false statements that the defendant made and shooting him 6 times, not 3, and that he had said it was a bump and rob, and that's not true, and this all was from an accident that happened earlier that he somehow thought Mr. Freeman was involved in, where there was no evidence that he was. I mean, all this is also part of the record. So how do you get to the point where you can argue to us that he was punished solely for exercising his constitutional right?
So a couple of things. Number one, there were comments that were made at sentencing that set the tone for this. So obviously, you know, whatever the court says has to be viewed in the context of everything that sort of comes up at sentencing, right? We're looking at the judge's words, but this is a hearing where other people address the court. The state told a story of rage and vengeance. I don't believe the court bought into that, because I think that the court saw it more as fear that was motivating Mr. Dotson, not rage. But there were still some comments that kind of just didn't fit, but set the table for this discussion about, you know, is this happening because we have more guns in our community? Is this happening because we're letting people have concealed carry permits? I'm going to quote 2 parts from the state's argument. One is at page 18 of the state's argument at sentencing, where the state says, but the public does still have a right to be protected from people who think this is some sort of game, or that this is not real, or that this is a movie or a video. There's no context for that, but the state...
This is the prosecutor, though.
This is the state, correct.
Okay, right. So how does that show that the judge did?
Well, just a couple more.
Okay.
The state said, we cannot just look the other way and chalk this kind of carnage up to our CCW laws or our self-defense laws or our castle doctrines or whatever we've got these days that are condoning deadly force. There's still such a thing as too much. The victim's mother briefly spoke, and she said, it is just too much with these conceals. It's just too much. So that's the context in which the court said, on this day, you set this in motion when you chose to go out and purchase a firearm, go out and be armed. So I think that that's sort of what set the table for it.
Just to clarify, counsel, though, if I heard Justice Dowd's question correctly, she phrased it as it has to be the sole factor on which the court based its sentencing decision. That's not the law, right? Because the law says you can't base sentencing on an improper factor. So, for example, if the judge instead had mentioned the defendant's race or religion as a basis for his sentencing decision, even if he went through all the Galleon factors and relied on all kinds of proper factors, the mere mention of an improper factor makes the sentencing an erroneous exercise of discretion, correct?
Correct, Judge, as long as the court relied on it, yes. So it's not the sole thing that the sentence is based on, but as long as the court relied on it, I think what I've been trying to explain is that the improper factor that shows the thing that best articulates the improper factor is that the court said, the day you bought this, you set it in motion. By that, he shows what it was that Octavia did wrong, right? He went and he decided to go armed. This became inevitable. So then when this happened, he wasn't properly judged. The court didn't look at the circumstances of the offense. The court said what happened is you had that thing in your hand that was making you have a distorted view of the world.
And under our own precedent, actual reliance is established if the circuit court gave explicit attention to an improper factor and if that factor then formed part of the basis for the sentence, right?
Correct, Judge. And, you know, counting the number of words when the court is sort of why this happened, it's focusing on this reason, and about half of the court's comments at sentencing relate to it. So I think that whether the court actually relied on this or not is it's probably fairly well established that the court did rely on this.
What's the standard if the court did rely on it? Are you agreeing that it's harmless error? That's the standard that we have to look at it under?
Right, Justice. So I didn't address structural error in my brief, as the state points out. The sort of framework with inaccurate information typically does involve harmless error. So that would be that if the defendant establishes inaccurate information and actual reliance, the burden shifts to the state to show that the error was harmless. It's not clear if structural error applies or harmless error. I believe that in something like this, where the court so relied on this belief and on this factor, either way, we meet the threshold. I would argue in favor of structural error because I think there's no way of making the sentence fair if the court is basing Mr. Dodson's fear, its understanding of Mr. Dodson's fear on these premises because he had a gun.
Does he have a constitutional right to use a firearm for an illegal purpose?
No, Justice.
And would committing second-degree intentional homicide, wouldn't that be an illegal purpose? I mean, how do you respond to the argument in the state, in Mr. Ladaraca's brief, that the Second Amendment wouldn't apply here?
Sure. So I think the state argued that because the belief of fear, because Mr. Dodson was unreasonable, that then essentially the court can treat it as entirely unfounded. I think, again, going back to, and I go back to this because it's how we're most familiar, in officer-involved shootings, a lot of times we look at different factors, and it's clear that sometimes threats are perceived in instances in which things appear to be one thing in the moment, and then it turns out that they're not. mistakes, essentially. And so I think that since we're not arguing about guilt or innocence here, we're just talking about sentencing, the judge has a responsibility to grapple with those facts and not to simply say, well, you know, you were afraid because you had
to go. So can we talk about that for a minute? Because I understand your argument, but I'm having a hard time with that, and maybe you can convince me otherwise, is that you are starting by looking at the facts from when your client's car was behind the victim's car. And this starts before that, where your client gets into a fender bender with a completely different car. So he gets into a fender bender with car A, he chases down the victim's car here, and then the victim comes out. I mean, it feels like you're missing the first couple chapters of what happened here.
Well, Justice, I mean, either it was Mr. Freeman or not, I think that...
I don't mean to cut you off, but from my reading of this, and I really do want to be corrected here if I have read this incorrectly, is there anything to indicate in this record that it wasn't, was Mr. Freeman who was involved in the hit and run?
Well, the only thing we have is the description of the car from Mr. Dotson. Mr. Dotson believed that they were the two cars. I know that he gave a different description of the car than what the car turned out to be. I don't know if his description was wrong or if he was wrong about them being the same car. I've thought about this a lot for a lot of years, and I really just can't answer the question personally, right? I think it could go either way. But I don't know that it has too much bearing on the case other than to say that Mr. Dotson was in about 5 minutes before, I think, according to the complaint, 5-6 minutes before the shooting, was in an incident, the rear-ending, the driving away quickly, that was sort of a trauma-inducing moment. It's probably something that made his heart rate go up. It's probably something that did make him, you know, afraid or something, right? I think that it's relevant in that regard.
Counsel, I think Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is waiting to ask a question. I could be wrong, but I want to make sure she gets that in. Justice Bradley? Or did you just have your phone unmuted?
I just had my phone unmuted, but no question at this time.
Okay,
thank you.
Though. All right.
Counsel, you're not here challenging the fact that the court sentenced your client based on the fact that he shot somebody wrongfully, right? You're here based on the remarks that were made during sentencing that arguably seem to punish your client for exercising his constitutional right to bear arms and to carry a weapon concealed, correct?
Exactly, yes.
Is it both that you're arguing, both the comment was improper both because it commented on his right to bear arms and because it commented on his right to obtain a concealed carry permit?
I think they're one and the same.
Well, they're not. But tell me how. Tell me how you think that.
In that they reveal a level of distrust and disdain in people that decide to go armed.
Counsel, the trial court and the Court of Appeals obviously read the transcript a little bit differently, and I just want to give you an opportunity to maybe directly address it, what they say. One reading of what the trial court said is that maybe all gun owners, you know, have their minds warped when they get a CCW license or they buy. The trial court and the Court of Appeals seem to say, in context, he's saying, listen, sometimes, he doesn't use the word sometimes, right? Sometimes when I see these defendants who come before me and they purchased a gun, it changes the way they think about the world around them and sets into mind some mindset that's unhealthy. And here I saw unhealthy, bad mindset with you. You went astray, and that's the context in which he seems to be making his comment. And I want you to respond to that. The trial court and Court of Appeals, again, both seem to contextualize it and say it relates to, you know, the crime here going to his mindset, which they say is proper, not so much the owning or using a gun or license per se, but that as playing into a proper sentencing factor. That's how they explain it, at least, and I just want to give you an opportunity to address that head on.
Sure. Everybody that comes before the court that shot somebody had a gun, right? So the court is necessarily going to see people in that situation. It's kind of a tautology to make those comments then, and they end up kind of losing all meaning, right? Because if the court says, I've seen people who are before me for shooting someone, they all had a gun, essentially, it doesn't mean anything. So what it does is it really just maligns anybody that has a gun, did it because of the gun, instead of the circumstances of the situation.
If he had used the word sometimes, sometimes when I see defendants come before me and used otherwise the same language, but used the word sometimes to describe a mindset he sees in some defendants in these kinds of cases, would that change your argument?
I mean, I think if he said sometimes, it would show that the court doesn't see a gun and just assume that the reason that the person acted this way was because of the gun. So if the court said sometimes, it would show some level of discretion and parsing and judging, frankly. Whereas if the court does not use the word sometimes, then the court says, this is the situation with the gun. The person must have had a distorted view of the world. So I think it does make a difference for my argument.
Good. Thank you.
Justice Ann Walsh Bradley?
Thank you. The court didn't say sometimes, but the court did say, quote, for whatever reason. It seems to me, in response to this, if you will, if a circuit court was set in its belief that the Dodson CW status caused him to view the world a certain way, the court wouldn't have said for whatever reason. It seems to me the court's trying to just make sense out of what the court really believes is senseless here. Can you respond to the for whatever reason comment?
Chief Justice, my light is red. I can respond, or I can respond on the rebuttal.
Respond now, please, sure. To her question.
Justice Bradley, I can't find the part that you're talking about. I think it's when he says whether the reason is because of the crime going on in this community. I believe that in context, what the court is saying there is, regardless of the reason you chose to go armed, you set these circumstances in motion. Am I talking about the same part that you're talking about?
Justice Bradley?
Is she muted?
Yes, thanks. I found it on Appendix 150 in the blue brief that the court stated that, or at least I thought the court stated that. Anyway, I'll ask further question on rebuttal.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel.
I'll look for that for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. LaRocca.
May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Dodson subjectively believed that Deshaun Freeman posed a danger to him, and acting with intent to kill, he discharged his handgun 6 times, striking Mr. Freeman 3 times. It caused Mr. Freeman's death. Now, Mr. Dodson recognized that his subjective belief about the danger that Mr. Freeman posed was unreasonable. It was not objectively reasonable. And he pleaded guilty to second-degree intentional homicide based on unnecessary defensive force. The question before this court is whether Mr. Dodson, the question before this court is whether Judge Donald's comments during the sentencing proceeding demonstrate or reflect an erroneous exercise of sentencing discretion. And it's a due process question, right? If it's an improper or inaccurate information or improper factor, it raises a due process question. And the state's position is as follows. First, Judge Donald's reference to the comments that are the focus of this appeal do not in and of itself reflect an improper factor. The fact that Judge Donald referenced the fact that he made a decision that he exercised his right is not improper under the facts of this case. Number two, even if the court were to reach the conclusion that Judge Donald's consideration of Mr. Dodson's lawful decision to carry a weapon in a concealed manner was an improper consideration, it does not flow from that Mr. Dodson has proved by clear and convincing evidence that Judge Donald actually relied on that in imposing the sentence. And reading the sentencing transcript as a whole and in context, which is what all of the cases, Alexander, Williams, and so on, require reviewing courts to do, it's not the case where Judge Donald's sentence was based on that. A careful reading of his comments when read in as a whole reflect that he was focused on the seriousness of the offense, but also spent a fair amount of time acknowledging the mitigating factors, the positives about Mr. Dodson, his crime-free background, the fact that he was working, the fact that he was supporting a family. So this is not a case where the court wanted to send a message, felt a need to punish or protect the public from Mr. Dodson further, or wanted to send a message to people who choose to carry guns concealed. There's none of that there. The court's
The PSI recommended 5 to 9 years based on his plea to second degree. But the court gave him 14 years in and 6 years extended supervision. What in his sentencing do you rely on for the lengthy sentence that the trial court meted out here?
Well, I note that the court, in passing sentence, identified the objectives of the sentence, identified the three common Galleon factors, discussed the maximum penalty for the offense. It is it's a Class B felony. It's a 60-year offense. What I look at in the record, it's the seriousness of the offense, ultimately. That decision that Mr. Freeman posed a danger to him, and as I believe the court said, nothing could be further from the facts in this case. The fact of the matter is it was not the same car, at least the evidence suggests.
Okay, but that's not – I want to know what he said in his comments that you can rely on for the lengthy sentence, because he's asking for an increase – he's asking for a remand for resentencing, right? He's not challenging his conviction. He's taking responsibility for what he did. But he wants another judge to resentence him, and what he relies on is that this judge seemed to rely on the judge's improper use of the fact that he was a concealed carry person and he had that gun on him at the time of this interaction. So can you address that, please? I mean, there are three things. He said the three things. The trial judges all re-say the three things, okay? Seriousness of the offense, character of the accused, and the need to protect the public, okay? When you look at the character of the accused, this guy, whatever you think about how this came together fact-wise, he pleaded to second degree. So you have to look at his character and what is the trial judge relying on for the character piece of sentencing. To me, he relies on the fact that he was carrying a weapon, and lawfully so.
I disagree, because there are other parts of this court's sentencing comments, and the court said it's taking into account, it identified what it's relying on, it read the pre-sentence, it listened to the comments of the parties, and the prosecutor went through in detail the discrepancies between, in discussing character, the discrepancies in Mr. Dodson's explanation about what happened and whether it fit the fact, actually fit the facts that were of record about, and I think about what led to this incident. Mr. Dodson had a view that he didn't do anything wrong, that Mr. Freeman just stopped his car and got out, but there's something else going on here. Why did Mr. Freeman feel the need to stop his car? What was Mr. Dodson doing?
I think all of that goes to whether or not second degree was properly charged, and he pled to it. So he's already saying, when he pleads to it, that looking at this now, in the cold light of day, his actions were unreasonable. Okay, so that's, he pled to that. That's the crime. And it's a serious crime. There's no question about it. The PSI writer knew it was a serious crime. They write these PSIs constantly, but they recommended only 5 to 9 years, but the circuit court gave him 14 years. This is a man with no prior record of doing anything except being lawfully employed and graduating from high school. That's what you do about him.
But I do believe that the circumstances underlying it reflect on his character in a negative way. There's the broad aspects of his character, which nobody disputes are positive in Mr. Dodson's case. And I think, as Judge Donald recognized, unlike many defendants that would have been appearing before him as he's presiding over a violent crimes homicide court in Milwaukee County. But that being said, part of character looks at how did you conduct yourself under a particular circumstances, and here was the crime itself. There's this auto accident, and what does Mr. Dodson choose to do? As he gets out of his car at the accident scene, there's a video that reflects he pulled his gun out, even though there was no indication that the person that bumped him was getting out of his car. In fact, that person fled off. This happened a mile away. And again, it's part of that is a reflection of his character and how one behaves in a crime. Now, true, he doesn't have a history of bad criminal character, but it's something that's there.
Mr. LaRock, I just want to follow up on what Justice Rogan
said. Thank you.
So Justice Rogan-Sack is saying, look, the PSI writer recommended 5 to 9 years. Judge Donald, the trial court judge, imposed 14 years. Understanding what Justice Rogan-Sack's concerns are, is the sentence itself, that is the 14 years, is that an issue in this case? Should we be concerning ourselves with
it? It isn't. There isn't a challenge that it was a harsh sentence within an Eighth Amendment context. And it probably, if such a challenge were made, it would be dismissed because it's nowhere close to even the max. And I recognize the court's concern, but that's not unusual to have probation agents make their own assessments.
Well, if he's not challenging the length of the sentence, what are we all doing here today? Why doesn't he just say okay and go home? Or to jail?
Well, no,
to
look, a court looking at, if this court were to reach the point that there was actual reliance, that the error was not harmless, and it remands for resentencing, then another court could impose a different sentence. It could impose the same sentence, but
More harsh.
Right. But what it can't do is punish him for taking an appeal in this case.
Right.
And it can't punish, it couldn't look at the prior act of obtaining it based on the court's ruling.
But clearly he's dissatisfied with the sentence he got, correct?
Correct.
Okay. He doesn't have to raise an Eighth Amendment challenge to be dissatisfied and ask for a resentencing, right?
Certainly, if you can challenge it, improper factors are based on due process,
right,
not harshness under the Eighth Amendment.
Right.
Counsel, I don't think there's any dispute here, that, of course, the trial court relied on all kinds of proper factors. But the issue is whether he relied on an improper factor. What do you make of the fact that the post-conviction court, it was a different judge who looked at this, Judge Stark, found that he did rely
on the factor. She just didn't think it was improper.
And obviously, we always have this situation when a case goes back in front of a judge different post-conviction purposes. I recognize that Judge Stark made that finding that, and I acknowledge that that's what the circuit court made, but it was a finding made on the record. It in a sense is a finding that when the judge is sitting as a post-conviction court like that, it's not the judge that's presiding. In a sense, it's sitting like a reviewing court. And so I do think whatever that court did, whatever the Court of Appeals did, this court independently reviews that. And ultimately, what she did find, even if this was an improper factor or was an improper factor, there was not actual reliance. And picking up, I think, on language that was in the Williams decision and so on, that focused on the context of the sentencing comments and looked at the sentencing transcript as a whole in deciding no actual reliance.
Counsel, are you familiar with the Lemon case from the D.C. Circuit? That was the defendant was a member of the Black Hebrew sect, and the sentencing court gave attention to the fact of his membership in this group when he was sentencing him for the crime. And that sentence was vacated and remanded for resentencing. And the court said, a sentence based to any degree on activity or beliefs protected by the First Amendment is constitutionally invalid. Do you think we should be applying a different test with respect to the Second Amendment? I'll note that the Supreme Court of the United States, at least some members, have noted that lower courts sometimes treat the Second Amendment as a second-class amendment or right. Can you see any legal basis for treating somebody's exercise of their Second Amendment rights differently than their exercise of First Amendment rights?
It's an issue I researched. I haven't found courts that have gone one way or another or addressed a situation like this. This court has said that these rights are fundamental, that it's a fundamental right, that whether one's looking at the state constitution or the Second Amendment. So with that, I think it fits within this rubric of improper factors. And the courts, through its decisions, in Alexander, I believe it was the attachment or appending of a compelled statement during a revocation proceeding to a pre-sentence report, court said that was improper because a compelled statement to a probation agent is considered involuntary. And so putting aside, acknowledging that was improper, the court then went to the next step of the analysis and said there was no actual reliance. The case, I believe, Lemon, that you reference is a case that gets picked up in Wisconsin and I believe a Court of Appeals decision called First, maybe, or Forst, F-U-E-R-S-T. It's a case that precedes a U.S. Supreme Court case, one that I wish I'd put in my brief in hindsight, Dawson versus Delaware. That's a First Amendment case dealing with associations. In that case, it's a capital case in which there was in which the defendant claimed that evidence of Dawson claimed that evidence of his membership in the Aryan Brotherhood was an improper reference to his freedom of association. And interestingly, in an 8-1 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, authored by Justice Rehnquist, the court said the Constitution does not erect a per se barrier to the admission of evidence concerning one's beliefs and associations at sentencing simply because those beliefs and associations are protected by the First. So one could arguably rely on the framework used in Dawson to say that it's not improper. Now, this court has only referenced, there's only one opinion by this court that I could find which references the Dawson case, and that's State versus Mitchell, which was later in a dissenting opinion. Mitchell is the case dealing with the constitutionality of the hate crime enhancer. And in Mitchell, the U.S. Supreme Court, in Wisconsin versus Mitchell, the Supreme Court said it's not improper to consider when there's it's not improper to consider someone's words when there's conduct that goes with those words that's criminal conduct, and you can enhance for that reason. And again, they draw back to Delaware, Dawson versus Delaware. And I note that there are other cases, as I said, I could find very few cases nationally dealing with Second Amendment. Is it an improper factor or being argued or used as an improper factor in a sentencing case? Obviously, the cases that we have seem to be deal with issues like First Amendment, freedom of association, freedom of religion or establishment clause issues, and other protected types of beliefs. But it's not to say that those cases don't provide a framework for looking at this particular case here.
Is it the state's position that Judge Donald did not rely on this factor, or is it your position that he did rely on it, but it was not improper?
When I read the transcript as a whole, and I read it in context, I'm looking at what he said. He never said, I'm sending a message to gun owners everywhere. I don't think people, he never made comments about, he never expressed a normative judgment or a subjective belief that gun ownership is bad. What he said is, in my experience as a judge, well, what's he talking about? He's talking about his experience sitting in a violent felony court in Milwaukee County where he sees a lot of gun violence. And so when he's talking generally about people who possess guns, he's asking a question, because if you look at right before that, he says, I'm baffled by how this happened. I'm trying to figure out what happened in this case. And I think judges do that. They want to understand, how is it that these two lives came together and someone died, someone was a victim, and someone is before me, and a judge then has to do perhaps one of the hardest things a judge does, and that's impose a sentence.
But the judge is supposed to give a particularized sentence that is individualized for this particular person. What troubles me about the comments is that it wasn't just a stray phrase or comment. It was several sentences about how people in general, a category of people who choose to exercise their Second Amendment right and carry a concealed weapon lawfully in the state of Wisconsin, how that changes those people as a group. That's how I read his comments, and that I find troubling because it wasn't directed at this particular defendant. He didn't draw on, well, I look at these aspects of your life, and that shows me that once you decided to carry the gun, Mr. Dodson, that changed you as a person. The judge talked about how people who choose to carry a weapon, and I, you know, you can read it maybe two ways, but the way I read it is that those people have a distorted, misguided belief of the world.
Let me respond to both of those. First, when he's making the general comment about people who possess firearms, the prefatory comment to that sentence is, in my experience as a judge. So he's not talking about his philosophical or political beliefs. He's saying, I see people who come before me, and they're people who've unlawfully used firearms. Now, he's not saying that. He doesn't expressly use those words, but I think it is a fair inference to draw, and that these people, when they have those firearms, it changes how they react and respond to people.
But he went further than that. He referenced carrying concealed permit, going out, purchasing an firearm, the extended magazine, his rational beliefs for possessing it, and his feeling he had to arm himself. And it's all those things that came together and set this day in motion, which is this crime happened, it seems, because you're someone who got a carrying concealed, bought a weapon, bought an extended magazine, and it's those things together that are part of this distorted, misguided belief and set this crime in action. No?
This is where I disagree with counsel, and that is how the words distorted and misguided belief are used. It's not referring to the prior paragraph on guns. It's referring to Mr. Dodson's belief that Mr. Freeman posed a danger to him. And he makes that comment twice. It's a distorted, misguided belief of the world that somehow Mr. Freeman was a threat that required you, in essence, to terminate his life. That's on page 31 of the transcript. And on page 32, you were operating under some misguided belief, some distorted view of the world, that somehow Deshaun Freeman was a threat to you, when in reality it was nothing further from the truth.
Except so, the paragraph before that, the judge talks about how he's seen over time how individuals possess a firearm, how that changes them, how they view the world, how they react and respond to people. And there's a direct connection between people who possess and then that other group of people who get a carrying concealed, go out and purchase, and they get something like an extended magazine. And then this distorted, misguided belief of the world and the need to protect yourself.
But when I look at the transcript, I look at the comments on distorted and misguided belief as a focus on what danger Mr. Freeman posed to him. That's how I think when I read the whole transcript in context, that's how I think it should be read. It does follow immediately after, but that second reference on page 32 is after, again, the court's discussing the seriousness of the offense and then the character of Mr. Freeman. And again, it's focusing on Mr. Dodson and whether Mr. Freeman was a threat. That's the distorted belief. And in fact, when one looks at Mr. Dodson's own comments, his own counsel's comment at the sentencing hearing, his counsel said it was that Mr. Dodson engaged in a gross overreaction. Well, that is the kind of comment that I think fits with the judge's comments, distorted, misguided belief that Mr. Freeman posed a threat to him.
The problem I have with that construction and interpretation of the words, and the words really do matter, is that the judge didn't say it appears that it is a distorted, misguided belief that somehow Mr. Freeman was a threat to you. He said it is a distorted, misguided belief of the world, after he just went on about how concealed carry permit holders who exercise their constitutional right to bear arms are a problem in society. He didn't use those words, but he said it set in motion crime, basically that somebody who carries a concealed weapon is more prone to committing a crime of violence like this.
I recognize we disagree, but I don't read that language into this. I think the court was stating an observation, a fact. And he wasn't, the Ogden case talks about predispositions. This isn't a case where the judge said, I'm going to punish anybody who comes into my court and has committed a crime with a gun and uses, and whether they possessed it lawfully in a certain way. This is not a case where the judge says, I dislike the law. I think this is a wrong view of the world. I think it's a fact. If Mr. Dodson had not had that gun that day, Mr. Freeman would be alive. That's another way to take that statement. And I don't think it's an unreasonable way to look at it. Now, the court's correct. And
counsel, he did say it changes how they react and respond to people. He wasn't talking about Dodson. He was talking about people who lawfully carry a concealed weapon. And that's why, reading that in context, it appears it is a distorted, misguided belief of the world. That's pretty easily attributed to the people he was talking about, meaning the people who exercise their constitutional right to bear arms.
I don't read it that way. He didn't use the word lawful or unlawful. He was talking about his experience as a judge, and as a judge presiding in a felony courtroom, which deals with violent crime, he's talking about that group of people. I read it differently.
Mr. Ladaraca, I'd like to give Anne Walsh Bradley a chance to chime in. I think she's trying.
Thank you. I'm going to return to those words of, for whatever reason, as I referenced earlier, there we were on page 150 of the appendix in the blue brief, but it is, which sets forth page 31 of the transcript. And it is those words, for whatever reason, that seem to be bridging the discussion that's been going on between the members of the court and counsel right now. And that is, after setting up a number of items referred to by questions of my colleagues, getting a CCW permit and getting an extended magazine. But after that, the next paragraph is, it is clear to me, Mr. Dodson, that for whatever reason, it appears that it is a distorted, misguided belief of the world that somehow Mr. Freeman was a threat that required you, in essence, to terminate his life. Makes no sense. And again, as counsel indicated, that sentiment is repeated on the next page of the transcript also, that the misguided belief the distorted belief was that Mr. Freeman was a threat that required you to terminate his life. So is there any import to the words for whatever reason? There is to me, but I don't know if there is to others, and I'm asking you.
I don't know. And, you know, we often tell juries when we instruct them, you can't look into a witness, you can't look into a witness's or defendant's mind. You can't look into a witness's mind. And sometimes I think we have to do our best to discern what a trial judge is saying. And I think there has to be some acknowledgement, and that's why this court is very deferential and why defendants have a heavy burden in showing an erroneous exercise of discretion, because there's a recognition that these proceedings are fluid. They depend in part on what defendants state. They depend in part on what counsel says, what the prosecutor says, what defense counsel says. And so I believe it's a transition or segue into the specifics of this case and the belief that Mr. Freeman was a threat.
Mr. LaRocca, in response to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question, you started talking a little bit about the legality of possessing the firearm, and I asked your opposing counsel whether or not he believes that Mr. Dodson was using the firearm, or whether or not he had a Second Amendment right which permitted him to use a firearm for an illegal purpose. And he talked about second-degree intentional homicide and how, in this instance, he thought that his client did in fact use it properly. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
I think it goes to the core of the Second Amendment and decisions like Heller, which draw a line between lawful behavior and unlawful behavior. And what Mr. Dodson was being sentenced for here was his unlawful behavior of using a firearm to take Mr. Freeman's life under circumstances for which circumstances that just made no sense to the court. I think is the essence that as the state, there are cases that may well come before the court where it's clear a judge is punishing somebody for lawfully having a gun, and the gun has nothing to do with the case. That's not this case. The gun was the instrumentality of Mr. Freeman's, that caused Mr. Freeman's death, that was the basis for the crime. And I don't know how a court can ignore how it is someone had a firearm. And many cases involve people who lawfully have them. Many involve people who don't lawfully have them when a more serious crime has occurred. And I don't think it's unreasonable for a court to ask and wonder, how is it you had this gun? Well, we know he had it in a lawful manner. I see my time is up, and I'm concluded. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Counselor?
Counsel, I certainly want to hear your responses to the state's argument, but I do have a somewhat fundamental question. If you could answer it in the course of your next presentation, please. Are you making a claim solely under the Second Amendment? Are you making a due process claim or both?
Justice Bradley, the whole idea of having a fair sentence is a due process claim traditionally. But I think much as the state pointed out in Alexander, the violation was a Fifth Amendment violation, or rather violated his Fifth Amendment that the statement was used, but the fact that the court would have relied on it at sentencing would be a due process violation. So in the sentencing context, it's due process. It's a hybrid violation, but it has to fundamentally be a due process violation for it to affect the sentence. And so that's where I think that ends up.
And just to follow up on Justice Kurofsky's last question to the state, she asked it of you as well. You're not suggesting in any way that the judge shouldn't have punished your client or sentenced him based on the fact that he killed somebody using a weapon, right?
No, not at all. I recognize, of course, this is a very tough issue. It's a divisive issue. I think that people have different ideas about this. Roughly speaking, about a third of people believe that more guns make us safer, a third believe the opposite, and a third are in the middle. But what we can't have, and this is why it's a due process violation, is somebody in one third punishing somebody in the other third for believing that, for exercising that right, and for making that life choice. Mr. Dotson was sitting before the sentencing court because he made a mistake that night, and he was there to be judged for it. The PSI writer reviewed it. They believed it was 5 to 9 years is appropriate. The judge is free to disagree with that. But based on his comments at sentencing, the sentencing court put an inordinate amount of care and attention on the fact that Mr. Dotson chose to become armed and mentioned that specific day as the day that this essentially became inevitable. I think that's unacceptable. There's no more questions.
Did you have any other answers to Justice Ann Welsh Bradley's question right before?
Oh, sure. Thank you. I appreciate it. I did, and I had it ready, and I lent it to counsel, and then I just got it back. the way I read this construction, it seems clear to me, Mr. Dotson, that for whatever reason, and it appears to me that a distorted, misguided belief of the world, that somehow Mr. Freeman was a threat. I think what the court's saying there is, you thought he was a threat for whatever reason, and it appears to me that that is because of this distorted, misguided belief in the world. The distorted, misguided belief in the world he's talking about is the thing where, according to the court, when someone has a gun in their hand, they see everything as a threat. So I think that specifically he's saying that the gun in your hand, that's why you saw him as a threat.
Thank Anything you. Else? All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments and good briefing on these issues. Hopefully, Xavier High School found this to be an interesting experience here today. And Justice Kurofsky, out to speak with you for a brief period of time, but I just want to thank everyone for coming today. Thank you for your arguments, and have a good, safe day.